Oh, hey, I'm Coco, and welcome to our talk show, Single and Too Tired to Mingle. We'll be talking about relationships with ourselves, our exes, our kids, and other important beings. So stay tuned. Hi, Janan.
Hello.
Welcome. Lovely to host you today.
Thank you.
So Janan is a London-based American journalist, and you have worked for CNN, Newsweek, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, UNICEF, to say a few things about you. And your writing has been published in outlets including New York Times, The Washington Post, Foreign Policy, Scientific American. So you've been quite busy in the writing realm. And you were born and raised in Michigan, which is actually quite significant, as we'll see in a little bit. And whilst you have this amazing writing career, we're here for another reason today, which is a lot more personal to you. And you are a mother of twins through surrogacy, and you're currently writing a book on global cross-border surrogacy. So welcome again.
Thank you very much.
And maybe just tell us a little bit about, let's start, how you kind of met your now ex-spouse, and then we'll talk about the journey.
Okay. I met my ex-husband here in London. We'd met a long time ago and sort of dated and then sort of lost touch and then kind of met back up again 11 years later. And we sort of, you know, dated again, and we both, you know, were older, and we decided that, you know, we wanted to have kids. And so we kind of got married quite quickly because we wanted to try and start that whole process. And so pretty much right away after we got married, we started, you know, trying to have a child. And I was, let's see, I was 43, and I think he was 40 at the time. So we were older.
Okay. And I believe you already had your eggs frozen at the time, just in case?
Yes. So when I turned 40, as a, well, right before I turned 40 as a gift to myself, let's say, as a joke, I went through egg collection, and they got 5 eggs. And so I jokingly called them my, you know, in case of emergency, break glass eggs. So we had 5 frozen eggs. And so I thought, you know, this is fine. You know, as it had been explained to me, you know, you have these frozen eggs, you'll be good to go. But obviously that turned out to not be the case. But yes, so we started right away, and, you know, I wasn't getting pregnant. And so we went to my doctor here in London, my gynecologist, who's a fertility expert. And so I did everything. We flushed my fallopian tubes. We put, she put me through menopause early. We did, I mean, all sorts of crazy stuff.
What did the process of finding out that you as a couple were infertile?
So we, as I said, we went through a number of, we did IVF, we froze embryos, we did something called fresh transfers, where, you know, you create embryos and then they try to grow them for a couple of days and take them to blastocyst, which is 5 days. We did a number of those. We tried, you know, to put those embryos back. And I don't even remember at this point how many times we did it. It was a lot. Let's put it that way. And I remember very specifically, I was with a really good friend at Wimbledon, and we were watching a Rafael Nadal tennis match, and we were in center court, and I got a phone call from my gynecologist. And so I sort of ran down the cement stairs, and my doctor said to me, listen, we're going to do the transfer again tomorrow, but I just wanted to say to you that if it doesn't work out, I think we need to accept that you have unexplained infertility. And I remember it was this weird juxtaposition because, you know, Nadal had just done some amazing, you know, point on center court, and everyone's clapping and cheering, and I'm sobbing in the stairwell. And so we did the transfer the next day, and of course I didn't get pregnant. So that's when I kind of thought to myself, okay, this is, we've got to reconfigure this situation. And at that point, you know, I had some really good friends who were a gay Israeli couple who had just started the surrogacy process as well. And so I spoke to them about it, and they kind of really talked me through it in terms of, you know, this is how the process goes. It's not all crazy, you know, rich celebrities or billionaires who do surrogacy. That seemed to be the story that you got in all the magazines and the newspapers. But it's just normal people who, you know, instead of, you know, buying a new car every couple of years, you can save money, or, you know, so it was something that people that I knew and I could relate to were also doing it. So that's kind of that process.
So it seems quite simple, kind of you discussing this, but I'm sure there must have been a lot of emotional maybe drama mm-hmm. behind it. And what do these discussions look like with mm-hmm. your husband?
Well, it's interesting because just to fast forward very quickly, obviously, you know, we ended up having kids and twins and whatever, and it was, you know, a happy story in the end. But when I worked, I've been working on this book about surrogacy for the last 4 years, and it's been actually very cathartic to me mm-hmm. because it's gotten me to be able to talk about these subjects without crying at all, right. without whatever. But yes, obviously, when you're going through, you know, infertility, It is heartbreaking. It is, you know, you feel like everybody you know, like your friends look at their husbands and they get pregnant. You yeah. know, you see women walking down the street yelling at their babies and you just think, oh my God, like if I could just, you know, why are you yelling at your child when I'm desperate to have a kid? So it's very heart-wrenching and it's a terrible thing. And you feel very lonely and you feel very like, what did you do wrong? And I think that my now ex-husband didn't understand that. I mean, he was sad that we, you know, weren't having any luck. But, you know, he didn't get it because he's not a woman in terms of it's not your body that is essentially turning against you, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was really a lot of that I just was dealing with on my own. I mean, we did have conversations about it and we both desperately wanted to have children. So we just kind of thought, well, how else are we going to do this? And so that's when we kind of, as I said, decided to look into surrogacy.
Right. Okay. How difficult or easy is it to find a surrogate?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the most important things to understand is that when people use the term surrogacy, as a sociologist who's written a lot about surrogacy told me when I was interviewing her for my book, she said, you shouldn't call it surrogacy, you should call them surrogacies. Because what happens in one country is very different from what happens in another country. So, for example, we decided to do it in the United States because even though surrogacy is legal in the UK, there was a long waiting list, it's non-compensated, which I kind of think sometimes can create issues. Mm-hmm. Whereas the United States, most states have legal frameworks in place and contracts. And so we just kind of started looking at surrogacy in the US. Originally, I wanted to do it in my home state of Michigan mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons. One of which was at the time my mom was still living in Michigan and we thought after the babies were born, mm-hmm. we would be back with my mom and it would just be a lot easier. But I found out very quickly through my agency, which was based in Boston, that surrogacy contracts in Michigan are illegal. It's the only state where surrogacy contracts are considered to be a felony, wow. and you can face 5 years in jail and a $10,000 fine. Yeah. So that kind of, we weren't going to do it in Michigan. But my agency, I said I wanted to do it someplace, ideally near Michigan, so that again, right. we could go back home because we'd have to deal with passports and stuff because we lived in the UK. And so my agency introduced me to one surrogate who I wasn't particularly keen on because a lot of it is you have to have a good relationship with them from the start. And then they introduced me to Julie and her husband, Chad, and they lived in Illinois. And Julie has a master's degree in business. She's the executive director of a housing organization. Her husband also has an MBA and he runs the administration of a hospital. So this whole kind of stereotype of surrogates must be women down on their luck who yeah. have no money is completely not true. And so we really liked Julie and Chad. She enjoyed being pregnant. This is the other thing that was very interesting with the research that I did.
So what kind of criteria does a surrogate mother have to have to become a surrogate?
Well, first of all, we don't use the term surrogate mother. We say surrogate, or you can say gestational carrier, which is also a term that we can use. It depends on the agency. Right. If we're just talking about the United States, most legitimate agencies have a certain criteria. You have to be obviously over 21. You have to have had a live birth and right. be a parent, a mother yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to go through a lot of psychological testing and also physical. You can't have a certain BMI, for example. You can't have history of, you know, certain things just because, you know, if you're pregnant, if you had a bad pregnancy before, right, okay. obviously they're not going to work with you. So those are kind of the criteria. Again, I say legitimate agencies. And also legitimate agencies don't usually work with women who are hovering around the poverty line.
Right.
And that is because you don't want to have a surrogate who, if you're the compensation that you receive for surrogacy bumps you over a certain level, then maybe you lose your social benefits. Right. I think also sometimes people who are on social benefits, there's sort of an insecurity and an instability in terms of their financial situation. So, and surrogates tend to be, at least in the United States, from research that's been done, they tend to be middle class to lower middle class, mostly white women mm-hmm. who have jobs like nurses, PAs, they run small businesses, teachers. So it's a real, it's again, it's this stereotype of who, you know, really terrible, you know, TV shows seem to paint surrogates as, and actually who surrogates are. Again, this is just in the United States. It's a very broad landscape across the world. But if we're talking about the US,
So, Janelle, I believe there are two different types of surrogacies?
Mm-hmm. There's traditional or genetic surrogacy, which was sort of how surrogacy was until the mid-1980s. And that's where the traditional surrogate is also the egg donor. Mm-hmm. And then starting in 1986, when the first child was born through a gestational carrier, which was in my home state of Michigan, that means that the embryo comes from the intended parent. So it's either the intended biological mother and the biological father, or it could be an egg donor and the father's sperm, or it could be the biological mother and the intended father's, or, I'm sorry, donor sperm. But in other words, so there's no genetic connection in a gestational surrogacy. Okay. 95% of surrogacies now in the United States are gestational. And again, it is very important to note that there is no biological connection between the surrogate and the child that is born. And so we used a gestational surrogate, obviously. And again, traditional surrogacy is mostly used by, say, for example, you know, your sister can't have a baby, and so you would have the baby for your sister, or maybe your best friend or your niece. It tends to be some sort of relationship between two people that do a traditional surrogacy these days.
So does it ever happen that the surrogate changes her mind and she wants to keep the baby? Is that a thing or not?
Nope. Okay. I mean, in the United States back in the 80s, there was a case called Baby M. And that was where a traditional surrogate gave birth in New Jersey. And this is the time when surrogacy was very sort of in the early days. And so they didn't do psychological testing. They didn't do, you know, whatever. And she ran off with the baby to Florida. It went all the way to the New Jersey Supreme Court, where it was ruled that the father, the biological father, would raise the child. And so since that time in the United States, that's why contracts are so important in surrogacy. And what they do in the U.S., again, it's different in different countries, but it's very much, you know, you're working with a surrogate already who understands exactly what the ramifications, you know, what's going to happen, right? And so as far as I understand, there has not been a case in the United States where a surrogate has ever said, I'd like to keep this baby. Because again, 95% of them are gestational carriers and it's not their child anyway.
And they already have children.
And they already have children and they know. Okay. And a lot of surrogates will say, you know, it's like extreme babysitting. Right. Or, you know, they understand that, like, you know, as one British surrogate said to me, you know, I run a daycare. She's like, I'm not going to say to a family when they come at 5 p.m. to pick up their kid, actually, you know, I'm going to keep that child. Sorry. So that's kind of, I mean, I think that's, so I think surrogates very much, and surrogates are interesting because the ones that I've met and interviewed, they're a very particular kind of person. Mm-hmm. They're very dynamic. Mm-hmm. They're very independent. They're very, they know their mind. They're not these sort of like, you know, sad, forlorn women who, you know, and I think, again, that's the stereotype that
is
important.
What the media feeds up.
Exactly.
You're kind of preying on these vulnerable women who this is their only choice in life.
And I mean, again, this is, you know, the landscape is different from country to country. Sure. I'm not saying that there haven't been problems in places like India and Thailand, for example, that used to have cross-border surrogacy.
Right.
And there were cases where that happened. But in the U.S., it's very much, and let's say in Western developed countries.
The UK, is it similar? Or?
The UK as well. Okay. Israel is actually the only country that I know of where actually the state interviews both the intended parents and the surrogate. Canada, you also. So I think in developed Western countries, you have contracts and things in place for the most part where those kind of situations wouldn't happen.
Okay. Yeah. And tell us about your journey. About your twins. How did you decide to have twins?
So as I mentioned, we'd gone through years of infertility, and we, in the end, had to use an egg donor because we ran out of my genetic material. And so we got a number of healthy embryos, and we sort of thought, you know, we tried my in case of emergency break eggs, which didn't work. Right. She didn't get pregnant with those. We tried one of my embryos. My surrogate got pregnant and miscarried at 8 weeks. Yeah. And that was our last genetic material. So then we had to use an egg donor. So we had in most contracts in the U.S., you have 3 tries with a surrogate, and then you have to either renegotiate or find another surrogate. And so we knew that we just had one more try with Julie. And so we said, well, let's go for twins. And so we decided to go try a female embryo and a male embryo. And so the embryos were put in Julie, and I don't know, 10 days to 2 weeks later, we found out she was pregnant.
So let's just talk about this a little bit. How did you find out, how did you know the gender of the embryos?
Well, you test in the U.S. You can test. Okay. So they can tell what the, so they do lots of genetic testing in the U.S. Right. So for example, the first egg donor that we used actually did not work out because when they tested the embryos that they had made in a lab in L.A., mm-hmm. there were all these genetic problems.
Right.
And so you're able to test all sorts of things in embryos. And so you can tell what the sex is. And so we, you know, again, we wanted to have a boy, we wanted to have a girl.
Okay.
And so they grade embryos. And so we took the top rated girl, a top rated female, and the top rated male. And those were the ones that right. We used. And 9 months later, we got my 2 top rated children, which doesn't feel like that some days. When they're not listening to me, but yeah. So.
All right. So is there, okay, so let's talk about this maybe. Why not adopt versus having a surrogate?
Well, this is another question that oftentimes really upsets people who've gone through the sort mm-hmm. of infertility process because for me personally, we didn't adopt for a couple of reasons. One, we'd already gone down the pathway of IVF, and so we'd spent a lot of money and a lot of time, and we already at that point had genetic material.
Right.
Also, I had spent time working in a child care home in Russia,
right.
And I spent a month there, and I realized that it's a very particular kind of person that can adopt a child. A very special, wonderful kind of person, but also, you know, a lot of adoptions don't work out in the end. And so I knew from my experience in Russia that I didn't want to adopt children because I don't think that I had the capacity for that.
Right.
And plus, as I said, we'd already, and adoption, also the problem is that depending on your age, a lot of countries or a lot of states mm-hmm. in the U.S. will say, well, if both of your ages equal to, say, for example, 80, so that would be a 40-year-old couple, both 40, you can't adopt. And so we were already past that age limit as well. So, and I think it's very upsetting to people who go through infertility where people just say, well, why don't you adopt?
Because
that's like saying, you know, oh, you can't ride a bicycle, then why don't you get a motorboat? They're two completely different things in my mind. So yeah, they're not, in my mind, they're very opposite. Or not opposite, but they're totally different experiences.
So is there a legal time frame that you must tell the child how he was conceived in this world?
Well, again, I mean, it's all, you know, every country is very different.
Right.
So, for example, in the UK, if you go through a surrogacy either here or anywhere abroad and you want to get your child a British passport, you have to get them a British birth certificate. And so we had to go through something called a parental order.
Right.
So we had to have our surrogate based in the U.S., you know, say that she was not going to, you know, want to have the legal responsibility of our children. And so after about 9 months of doing that process, we were, you know, our children were adopted, which I still, the whole, anyway, the UK is changing their law, thank goodness, hopefully soon.
So does that happen just cross country?
No, but so point is that even in the UK, if you did a surrogacy, it says on the birth certificate, this child was, you know, born through, something about parental order.
Okay.
So the UK sort of outs you that you were born through surrogacy.
Right.
There aren't any laws necessarily, but I think that it's very important that from a very, pretty much from the moment my children were born, I was always very open with their birth story. And I tell them now, I mean, they're 6. We talk about how mommy had a broken belly. Mommy had broken eggs, but 2 very nice ladies, one very nice lady let me have her eggs and another very nice lady let me borrow her belly. And they don't, you know, they find it interesting, but not that interesting. So I think it's important that you tell the story age appropriate to your kids so that they don't wake up when they're 18 and they're like, wait, you're not my biological mother, or you didn't give birth mm-hmm. to me. Or so I think it's very important to be very open from the moment that they come on this planet.
Just a question. So you're saying that you kind of had a broken belly, that you discussed mm-hmm. that with your children. But like you said earlier, it was an unexplained mm-hmm. kind of infertility.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily. So maybe just the two Well, genetic components are not, you know, agreeable with each other.
No, I think it's just that, you know, it's because when they get to be in high school, I can explain a little bit more like petri dishes and sperm and eggs. But I do it because, I mean, my gynecologist said that usually when you have unexplained infertility, she said, we know a lot about eggs, we know a lot about sperm, we know a lot about ovaries, but we don't know a lot about the womb. And so usually women who have unexplained infertility, it's a womb issue, but they don't have a lot of research about why wombs don't work. Some women's lining is too thin. Some women's lining is too thick. They don't know. It's unexplained.
Okay.
And so, but yeah, for my kids' purposes, eventually we'll get into the more biological. Okay. But again, they're only six. They can't even read yet. So we're just going real basic right now.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, Gina, speaking of legislation, we've already touched upon the fact that different countries have different kind of laws, or maybe not even that. So let's touch specifically on Michigan, because your role in that is actually very active.
So in the United States, both surrogacy falls under both family law and contract law, and that is under the jurisdiction of states versus federal laws. Right. So every state creates their own sort of laws or legislation around surrogacy. Or they could, you know, in California, for example, there are no laws on the book, but it's through the court system that they kind of have the sort of laws and or aspects in place for surrogacy. In my home state of Michigan, as I explained earlier, it was that's where the first gestational carrier was born, or gestational surrogate child was born. It's a very long history of Michigan. It plays a very significant role in the history of global surrogacy. But in 1988, they created a law to essentially stop one man who was a lawyer who was doing pretty much a majority of surrogacies in the United States surrogacy contracts. So in 1988, that law made it illegal. When I was working on my book, I came across a woman who also had to use a surrogate out of state. She's based in Michigan, and she had started an organization called the Michigan Fertility Alliance. And she said, I want to change the law. And I said, yeah, thinking at the time, sure, okay, whatever. That was 4 years ago.
Right.
We have been working on this now for a long period of time. About a year and a half ago, we were connected with a number of national organizations who work on things like family law and surrogacy law. We have this consortium that we have worked on this bill, writing this bill, with some incredible legal minds. And so our Michigan Family Protection Act passed through the Michigan House back in November, and we are going in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee quite soon. We're not sure exactly when.
Okay.
And we were hoping, because it's a Democratic-led Senate, that the bill will pass and that it will be made into law. And it's not just a surrogacy law, it's also a parentage law to make sure that children who are born in Michigan, so for example, if your parents are same-sex couple and one's biologically related and obviously the other one isn't, and say they're not married, that the non-biological parent has as many legal rights and is listed on the birth certificate as the parent as well. So it's an all-encompassing law that we hope will make children in Michigan safe and secure, and that families won't have to go through the trauma of a lot of these legal processes that they have in the past.
Okay, that sounds like a very noble cause.
Yes, yes, we think so.
Okay, so what future do you see for assisted reproductive technologies?
Well, this week we saw a really scary thing come to pass in Alabama.
Okay.
The Supreme Court of Alabama ruled that embryos are children. I saw a really great meme earlier this week that said something to the extent of, you know, people going through fertility treatments are very aware of what embryos are, and there's nobody on the planet who cares, who understands more that embryos aren't children than people who are going through fertility treatments. And what that essentially means very quickly is that, you know, if somebody has embryos and they don't use them and they don't want to use them, they probably will not be able to get rid of them. And it would also mean that people going through fertility treatments
It's already expensive. It's already painful. It's already heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. That maybe it would mean you'd have to every time do a fresh transfer so you didn't freeze any embryos. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it's there. The implications we don't know because it literally is a week ago this ruling happened. But it's making many people very upset and nervous. And you know, who knows what's going to happen in the election coming in the autumn? But if they're coming for assisted reproduction and IVF, it's a very, very troubling concern, because reproductive rights in the States already faces a lot of problems, and fertility treatments, mm-hmm. we just thought was something that, you know, would not be touched, and now, you know, who knows what's going to happen, and it's frightening.
Okay. Just for the end, what would you kind of say to women who would like to have children, mm-hmm. but perhaps can't?
Well, one of my friends gave me a very good piece of advice when we were going through all this infertility. And she said, if you want to become a mom, you will. If you are that dedicated to, you know, being a parent, you will find a way. And I think in many ways that is correct. That is also correct if you have the financial aspects to do it. If you don't, that's a whole nother ball of wax, which is very sad. And we're working Michigan Fertility Alliance to also sort of get to make sure that, you know, fertility preservation and insurance coverage for fertility treatments. But I would say the one lesson that I've really learned from all of this advocacy work that I've been doing is that, you know, if you see something that you think needs to be changed, one person or a couple people working together can get those things changed. It has been the hardest thing that I've ever worked on in my entire life, working on this legislation. But if you think that, you know, in your country or in your state or wherever you live, you know, there aren't a lot of good options for your fertility care, mm-hmm. then you need to fight for it. And, you know, it'll be a battle, but it's very important. And I think that's something that I think is my takeaway is, you know, and so many women and men, after they go through infertility, they move on from it because it's so heartbreaking. And so I think a lot of people who were very fired up about it when they're going through infertility then just want to forget about it. Right. But my friend Stephanie, who started MFA, and I couldn't forget about it. And so we haven't forgot about it, and we won't forget about it. So
thank you so much, Janine. That was very inspirational. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Thanks.